Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the latest policy reversal of an Obama initiative announced by Trump on Twitter that the U.S. government will no longer accept or allow transgender Americans to serve in the U.S. military. The author of The Human Agenda, Conversations About Sexual Orientation and Gender, Joe Wenke, a writer, social critic, and LGBT activist, joins us to discuss what appears to be Trump's new routine of daily distraction, this time scapegoating a vulnerable community in a cruel and cynical attempt to distract the public from the Russia investigation, which is closing in on him and his family. We will look into Stephen Bannon's White House strategy of pandering to bigots who call themselves Christians in the alt-right's phony battle against the bi-coastal secular humanists consumed by identity politics who don't care about the white working class in the flyover states. Then we'll assess the impact on the European gas market dominated by Russia's Gazprom of the sanctions bill that just passed overwhelmingly in the House on a 419-3 vote. Fadel Gaid, the former senior energy strategist for oil and gas with Oppenheimer & Company, joins us to discuss what inroads U.S. shale gas and Qatari LNG have made into the European market and how much the new sanctions will affect Russia's Nord Stream 2 pipeline project under the Baltic Sea directly to Germany that bypasses Ukraine and Poland. Then finally, we'll examine the Israel Anti-Boycott Act introduced into the Senate by Democrats at the behest of AIPAC, the American Israel Political Action Committee, which is meant to head off the Boycott Divestment Sanctions BDS movement in America that already has proven effective in Europe. MJ Rosenberg, a senior foreign policy fellow at Media Matters, joins us to discuss how this bill will criminalize political speech and subject Americans to up to 20 years in jail and $1 million fine for just requesting information about BDS boycotts. And joining us now is Joe Wenke, who is a writer, social critic, and LGBT rights activist. He is the founder and publisher of Trans Uber, a publishing company with a focus on promoting LGBTQ rights, free thought, and equality for all people. He is the author of Free Air, Poems, Papal Bull, An Ex-Catholic Calls Out the Catholic Church, You Got to Be Kidding, A Radical Satire of the Bible, and Mailer's America. His latest book is The Human Agenda, Conversations About Sexual Orientation and Gender Identity. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joe Wenke.
Hi, Ian. Thanks for having me on the show again. It's a pleasure.
Well, thank you, Joe. And today, Donald Trump tweeted out that the United States will no longer accept or allow transgender people in the U.S. military, saying that U.S. forces must be focused on decisive and overwhelming victory and could not afford to accommodate transgender people in the military, citing costs, etc. So, and of course, he says all this after consultation with my generals and military experts, although at this point nobody knows who he's consulted, and there's a great deal of suspicion that he hasn't consulted anybody, and he's got people like Senator John McCain extremely upset. So what's going on here? I mean, is this another attack on Obama, anything Obama did? I mean, I know this is a daily train wreck, and you know it's hard for me covering this guy to keep up with him, but what's your take?
Well, it's very difficult to try to get inside Donald Trump's mind, and it's a little bit scary to attempt to do that. It could be a number of different things, and I you know, when we were talking before the interview, I mentioned that there's an article outside on the Washington Post, the New York Times, that a Republican congresswoman had placed into the current budget bill an amendment that would ban transgender people in the military from having access to gender reassignment surgery, and that perhaps Trump felt that that was going to jeopardize his budget, which actually does include funding for his infamous wall. That could be one reason. The other could be, of course, to create yet another distraction from the Russian investigation. It's very difficult to tell, but it's clear that everyone was blindsided by this. So my wild guess is that he did not consult with anyone. And, you know, quite frankly, this issue was studied in great depth and detail during the Obama administration, and that's why they had come to the conclusion that, yes, transgender people can serve in the military without it in any way jeopardizing our military readiness, because, hello, they're already serving in the military and have done so for decades. There are different estimates of how many transgender people are serving in the military, from 2,000 or 3,000 to as many as 15,000. But there are absolutely no instances, there's no evidence of transgender people causing a problem. It's analogous to all of the craziness and nonsense over transgender people having access to the bathroom that matches their gender identity. We never hear of transgender people causing problems in restrooms. It just doesn't happen. So these are fake issues. It's another example of Donald Trump, you know, perhaps also playing to the religious right. But he really has no ethics from my standpoint, my point of view. His only concern is self-interest. He's totally transactional, and this was his latest transaction.
Well, the fact of the matter is that the Family Research Council and Focus in the Family are very quick to praise Trump's tweet today. I didn't call it a policy change because it amounts to a tweet, but it is extraordinary to have this sort of government fiat via tweet. There was a study by the RAND Corporation that looked into the effect of transgender people in the active duty military. And as you say, of the 1.3 million active duty members in the military, according to this study, there were 2,450 are transgender. But in terms of cost, just to quote from the RAND report, transgender people have minimal impact on readiness and healthcare costs for the Pentagon. It's estimated the healthcare costs would rise $2.4 million to $8.4 million a year, which, of course, is infinitesimal in a $700 billion defense budget. So yeah, it's clearly a specious argument. So what's this going to do? I mean, Do you think, for example, the prominent Republican transgender person, Caitlyn Jenner, is she going to finally wake up and realize that her party is against her?
Well, maybe she will finally do that. I guess as a lifelong Republican, she's been blinded. She wanted to be sort of Trump's ambassador to the LGBTQ community, not realizing that he could care less about the LGBTQ community. I think she even had some nice things to say about Ted Cruz. So that's quite unfortunate. I mean, I think the real context to look at this really is that transgender rights are human rights. And if there is an attack on the rights of any American, all Americans should be offended by it and should stand up and support, in this case, transgender people, who are certainly among the most marginalized and discriminated against people in this country and in the world. And yet, despite that, are going on every day, doing their best to live their lives, to make a contribution, and in this case, risking their lives to defend our democracy. And so Donald Trump is yet again, with this act, undermining the very foundation of our democracy, which is supposed to be based on freedom and equality. But of course, he's done this from the very beginning, when he first began campaigning and based his campaign on birtherism and the racist idea that Barack Obama was not born in the U.S., his attack on Mexicans as rapists, his attack on Islam as an enemy of America, calling for the Muslim ban, his attacks on the press, his attacks on the judiciary, his attacks on U.S. intelligence. So it's really overwhelming. And then balanced against all of that is, of course, his bizarre admiration for Putin and Russia. And I think, again, one of the reasons he's doing this is that it's yet another distraction from that investigation. And it's clear with his public shaming of Jeff Sessions that he's becoming increasingly alarmed about that investigation. So I think all of this is tied together. And I think, like most Americans who support freedom and equality for all, I'm just in a state of constant of just being offended every single minute. I feel like I'm being bombarded. It's several times a day that there's yet another atrocity coming from Donald Trump. And this is not going to end well. That's all I can say. We are fast moving toward a constitutional crisis.
Well, of course, there are transgender individuals in the military at all levels of service, including in the elite SEAL teams.
Right.
And Chelsea Manning responded to Trump's announcement today saying, "So the biggest, baddest, most expensive military on earth cries about a few trans people but funds the F-35? Sounds like cowardice." Is this just like trans people are kind of low-hanging fruit for bigots? What's going on here?
Yeah, I think, again, because trans people are a relatively small percentage of the overall population, although increasingly more people are coming out as trans each year. The best estimate on the total number of trans people is now around 1.4 million. But this is attacking people who are vulnerable, who are easy targets. It solidifies his relationship with the religious right. You mentioned the American Family Association, Focus on Family. They're hate groups. Mm-hmm. They are anti-LGBTQ groups. They cloak themselves in religion to justify their hatred. And so this is really an act of cowardice on the part of Donald Trump, for whatever reason he has to do this, whatever twisted reason. And just as he was attacking, you know, as I pointed out before, obviously, you know, Mexicans and Muslims, he attacked the vulnerable. And it doesn't reflect well on him. And as in this case, it's transgender people, or whether it's immigrants or whether it's Muslims. And he scapegoats them. And that appeals to, unfortunately, a certain segment of the American electorate. But I think in the process, he's not only damaging himself, he's really demeaning the office of the presidency. He's showing that he is unfit to be president, but I don't see that this is sustainable. I don't see it as ending well. And we're following, of course, the ongoing investigation, and I think he's becoming increasingly alarmed. And I think he's going to act more and more erratic all of the time. And today's announcement, you know, this bizarre announcement out of the blue that he's banning transgender people from serving in the military, even though transgender people already do, is just part of that.
Well, according to Axios, their reporter, Jonathan Swan, who seems to be one of the better journalists on the beat at the White House, one administration official told him that the move was intended to force Democrats from Rust Belt states to take, quote, complete ownership of this issue. So this looks as though this is Steve Bannon at work, isn't it? This is the alt-right cynical strategist basically scapegoating people in this cruel and cynical way to score political points.
Exactly. I mean, this is pure Bannon. This is Breitbart. That's what that website has been championing from the beginning. It's really all about discrimination, scapegoating minorities. This is a very ugly side to this whole Trump phenomenon. And, you know, what people don't talk about enough, it's so difficult to talk about really, is what about his supporters? I mean, I understand a percentage of his supporters are people who were looking for jobs. And perhaps they're desperate. And they thought he was going to come into Washington and, quote, unquote, drain the swamp, which has turned out to be a joke. But there is a significant segment of people who like this, who resonate with this sense of, you know, anger and outrage and feel like they've been victimized because they do not want to have a diverse society. Mm. Bannon is all about, you know, white supremacy. And about having, you know, a culture that is less diverse. And that is a very, very troubling thing, I think. It should be to all Americans who love freedom and equality and who embrace diversity. So, again, going back to this transgender ban in the military, we should all be outraged by this. You know, it's the old saying, they may be coming after one group today that you don't necessarily relate to, but they could be coming after you tomorrow. Right. And I think that we're seeing that.
Just in the last minute, Joe, this is very personal for you, isn't it? Isn't he going after people like you in particular?
Yeah, since the last time we spoke, I've transitioned, and I now identify as a transgender woman. But there are other people that I know and love who are also transgender. And I think what people need to realize is that transgender people are just like everybody else. We just have a different gender identity. And everyone has a gender identity, that is to say, how we all experience and communicate gender. And there's a broad spectrum. And most people's gender identity is aligned with their anatomical sex. And in a small percentage of people, it's not. But there is nothing scary about that. There's nothing threatening about it. There is nothing pathological about it. Being transgender doesn't increase your blood pressure. It doesn't give you higher cholesterol. It's not life-threatening at all. It's simply an alternative gender identity. And I think if we can move toward common ground and see that a threat on any individual's or any group's rights and freedom of expression is a threat on all of us, then maybe we can pull together and respond appropriately to what I do think is certainly a threat to our democracy that we're seeing, that Donald Trump has a strong authoritarian tendencies, and he is doing everything he can to solidify a base of people who will support him. And today's action is just another example.
Well, Joe Wanky, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's been my pleasure as always, Ian. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Joe Wanky, who's a writer, social critic, and LGBT rights activist. He is the founder and publisher of Trans Uber, a publishing company with a focus on promoting LGBTQ rights, free thought, and equality for all people. He's the author of Free Air Poems, Papal Bull, An Ex-Catholic Calls Out the Catholic Church, You Gotta Be Kidding, A Radical Satire of the Bible, and Mailer's America. And his latest book is The Human Agenda, Conversations About Sexual Orientation and Gender Identity. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back looking into how the sanctions bill that just passed the House overwhelmingly will impact the natural gas market in Europe, dominated by Russia's Gazprom.
Ooh, love breaks the machine. Everything's half a dream, how can it be? Everything's born in shame, it's not just me. Particle wave duality, how can we ever evolve? When our gods are so primitive, they destroy our hope for peace, hope for love.
Excuse me, mister, but is that natural for? And the pollution in the air, mister, whose could that be? So excuse me, mister, but I'm a mister too. And you're giving mister a bad name, mister like you. So I'm taking the mister from...
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Fadel Guite, who is the former senior energy strategist for oil and gas research with Oppenheimer & Company. Mr. Guite has more than 30 years of experience in oil and gas research and has previously been with Mobil Oil at J.P. Morgan Company in New York. He's one of the most quoted analysts on energy issues and has testified before the United States Senate and the U.S. House of Representatives about oil and gas price speculation. Welcome to Background Briefing, Fadel Guite.
Thank you for having me.
And the sanctions bill that has passed the House and is likely to pass the Senate with a pretty strong majority that might well override a presidential veto if one were to come is being greeted in Europe with a certain coolness. The European Union's officials are worried that these new U.S. sanctions against Russia might cause problems in Europe's energy market. So, I mean, we've had occasions before where the Ukrainians cut off the gas supplies to Germany, et cetera. I know that Russians are building or want to build a pipeline to avoid under the Baltic Sea to avoid Poland straight into Western Europe and Ukraine. But at this point, do you think this is actually going to put the squeeze on Russia to punish Putin for meddling in the American elections?
Absolutely. This is the only thing that will make Putin pay any attention. These are not empty words. They are going to be in effect and will have, obviously, negative financial impact on Russia. On the other hand, it's going to help the European. It will definitely strengthen their position. Putin and Russia are not in a position to exert any pressure on Europe. It is the other way around. A U.S. sanction will bring probably Russia and Europe closer, because Russia definitely depends on gas sales to Europe. On the other hand, Europe is very dependent on gas imports from Russia, especially the former Soviet republics, almost 90% to 90%. Poland, the Czech Republic, and all these countries have very high percentage of their gas consumption coming from Russia. Germany and Italy are also very high percentage, but they are a long-term and key customer, and I don't think that Putin and Russia can really tinker with this formula, because they cannot afford to lose their largest customer in Europe.
Well, apparently the sanctions target any company that contributes to the development, maintenance, and modernization of Russia's energy export pipelines. And that's very likely to impact this new Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which is owned by Gazprom, that goes under the Baltic Sea, and it bypasses Ukraine and Poland and other Baltic states. I mentioned earlier that the Ukrainians turned the tap off at one point, or the Russians turned the tap off to punish Ukraine, and then Ukraine in turn punished Western Europe. So
correct.
That's the vulnerability and the dependence that Europe has, Western Europe has, on Russian supplies. That's a pretty stark example. So what do you think then? Is there any long-term U.S. strategy to wean the Western Europeans from Russian dependence, or do the Europeans themselves want to be weaned from Russian dependence?
30 years ago, when Gazprom started opening gas markets in Europe, Ronald Reagan, the American president, warned the European Union about being more dependent on energy imports from Russia. And he was absolutely right. Oil is, you know, an economic weapon. As far as gas, is the same situation. Europe cannot survive without Russian gas, or at least is going to be dealt a very heavy economic blow, if you will, if that were to take place. But the sanction would definitely rattle Russia and Putin, and I'm sure that being the chess player he is, he must have plan B or even plan C. But nevertheless, the options are going to be equally unattractive, and the U.S. has the upper hand for all practical purposes. Trade with the U.S. is very critical to Russia, as well as the U.S. leadership in terms of leading, global sanction against Russia for their, misdeed in Ukraine and Crimea and elsewhere.
And again, I'm speaking with Fidel Guide, who's the former senior energy strategist for oil and gas research with Oppenheimer & Company. He has more than 30 years of experience in oil and gas research and has previously been with Mobil Oil and J.P. Morgan Company. And he's one of the most quoted analysts on energy issues and has testified before the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House of Representatives about oil and gas price speculation. Now, I understand that I think it was when the tap was turned off over the Ukraine situation vis-a-vis Russia and Ukraine and Crimea, that some of the Europeans were talking about diversifying their supply. Didn't the Dutch build an LPG terminal, a liquid petroleum gas terminal?
That's correct. Sales. One is in the UK, one in Italy. So they have done, fairly good job, but it is not 100% foolproof, if you will. It will reduce their dependence on gas imports from Russia, but it's not going to be sufficient to really offset the entire disruption, if disruption were to take place.
So is there a way to sort of paint a broader picture here, in the sense that we have this peculiar situation going on in the Gulf, where the young Saudi king, who got the country into a war in Yemen that he doesn't seem to know how to get out of, and now has blockaded Qatar, which has, I think, the biggest gas supplies in the world, or certainly up there with Russia. And that seems to be sort of also backfiring on Mohammed bin Salman. But is there anything going on here in geopolitics here? Because, you know, Russia's involvement in Syria, for example, would block any pipeline that could pipe gas from Qatar into Europe, would it not?
Well, it will make life much more difficult for the Qataris for a couple of reasons. Number one, the LNG tankers will have to go through if the Suez Canal is not available or blockaded, because Egypt is part of the group of countries in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and the United Arab Emirates, that they impose economic sanction on Qatar. But gas will seek its natural market, and for all practical purposes, the European market will be very attractive for the Qatari. The original, obviously, destination for the Qatari is basically Asia, and, you know, Japan, Taiwan, and, you know, the
South Korea, right?
Yeah, China. So there is plenty of natural gas. There is no shortage, but there could be some misallocation, and that could disrupt the market. And, you know, traders will have a field day and will probably spike gas prices to very high level that are not sustainable. But the market will balance itself. But if I were to take winners and losers, the Russians will definitely be on the losing side. The question is, if they would lose, the question is by how many points. So they will lose, but we don't know, is it going to be a big defeat or a small defeat or what. But definitely, any disruption of gas flow from Russia, they can ill afford, the economic impact. Putin want to bring himself back into, cooperation and peaceful resolution of things. But at the end of the day, he can change the color of his skin, but not what's deep inside him. And he still has this grandiose plans of recreating greater Russia and blame the U.S. for, breaking up the former Soviet Union and all this nonsense. So economic sanction is the only way that the U.S. or any other country can deal with Russia. Obviously, any nuclear confrontation is not going to be in the cards. Nobody wants it. But economic sanctions seem to be very, very attractive, non-lethal means to reach whatever objective that needed to be. As far as what is happening in Saudi Arabia, it's a very messy situation. Young, naive, inexperienced, very brash young man. He already put his country in a very deep hole, and it looks like it's getting worse. It's going to get deeper and much, much worse. He created a human catastrophe in the southern border of the Saudi Arabia. And it's not going to bode well for Saudi Arabia or for the whole region. So that could be part of the spillover, if you will, from the regional politics into the global scale.
But Fidel Gait, wouldn't it make sense for the Qataris to pipe their gas through Iraq and Syria into Turkey or into the Mediterranean? Has there ever been any plans to do that? Because at this point, there's obviously Iran pretty much controls Iraq, and Russia and Iran control Syria and Turkey.
Yeah, but I am not sure the infrastructure is there to take the gas by pipeline into Europe, it has to be going through, obviously, LNG tankers and is going to go, you know, into the Dairy gas plant, where the terminals that have been built both in the UK and in Italy. And unfortunately, Germany should have done that 5 or 6 years ago, build a receiving gas terminal, the LNG to put it in the gas grid. And now the U.S. is, we are totally flush with gas and we don't know what to do with it. And there are only one or two new projects. One of them is in operation. The other one is still on the rolling board. But the U.S. definitely can substitute the gas import by Europe. But it's going to take a while. I mean, building an LNG terminal takes 3 to 5 years to build. It's not weeks, it's not months, it's years.
Well, some Russian officials, Alexei Pushkov, for example, a legislator in the Duma, wrote on Twitter, "The exceptional nation," that's the United States, or a kind of derogatory way of talking about the United States, "the exceptional nature wants to block Russian gas supplies to Europe and to sell expensive shale gas from the US to its European servants. That's the entire morality of Congress." So let's sort of pass that statement. First of all, is shale gas in the US competitive, particularly in a liquefied form?
Absolutely. It will be competitive. But as I said before, it's a matter of time. And, you know, if there is a will, there is a way. And the industry, because you have to remember also, the key players, if you will, into LNG, they are, you can count them on one hand. There are only 4 or 5 companies that can undertake this investment. We're talking about tens of billions of dollars and years to complete. Nobody has the appetite for that. There is plenty of LNG. And, you know, for all practical purposes, it is not the best investment right now. If you look down the road and you don't see any upside potential for oil and gas prices. The problem with gas, like it's the same problem with oil, there is plenty of oversupply. And, you know, any idea that we will see, most of the LNG is basically sold on agreed upon contract and pricing structure and all these things. Companies don't build LNG facilities on spec. And wait for the market to develop. It's the other way around. Before they, dig a hole in the ground to build the infrastructure, they have to have 80% of the LNG already under contract, long-term contract, 25 to 30 years. So why? Because of the fact that you are putting huge capital at risk. When Chevron, Shell, and Exxon built the Gorgon gas project, it cost $60 billion. It was originally planned at $40 billion, 50% overrun. It's definitely underwater. It's not going to earn its cost of capital. It has been an economic disaster. So that scared the market in general. No one is going to venture into a situation like that without knowing what the economic returns will be and have to be guaranteed. And in this market, nobody can guarantee that.
But just in the short term, in terms of U.S. pressure on Europe and trying to diversify their gas market and make it less dependent on Russia, won't this basically mean that the Germans and the Dutch and the Italians and the French, etc., won't they be able to get a better deal out of Russia because they're in a stronger bargaining position now, aren't they?
Absolutely, absolutely, absolutely. And shale gas will play a part, but it's not going to be big enough to offset the entire volume of gas Europe is importing from Russia. But nevertheless, it will send very, very strong message to Russia and to Putin. Listen, you are not the only pretty girl in the block. There are other options, and one of them is. And the U.S. shale producer, they are a scruffy bunch. They don't blink even with OPEC and are not going to blink, you know, with Russia. I mean, they will look at what is economic. If it's economic for them, we will have projects built.
So does this mean then that the Russian revenues, the sanctions aren't being lifted? I mean, the votes are pretty stark. The House voted 419-3 in the sanctions package.
Absolutely. But it is not immediate. The other thing is important for us to understand. The gas from Gazprom is going into long-term contract on predetermined price. So the German is not going to say, go back to Russia and say, listen, guys, we're not going to be able to pay you, say, $8 per million BTU. We are going to pay you only $6. It's like, they don't do business this way. But longer term, the view, when we renew the contract, then the European will be in a much better negotiating position than any time in the last 5 years.
Well, I was just going to say, though, the sanction bill passed the House by 419-3, and an early version of the bill passed the Senate 98-2. So it's pretty unanimous. There's no way that Trump can that he'll have successfully be able to veto it. So this means then that the sanctions are getting worse, not better. And there's going to be less revenue for Russia, which is already suffering under the current regime. So they're turning up the screws on Putin. That's what it comes down to.
The other thing is very important here for you to understand. The Senate and the House, they are sending message not only to Putin, but also to Trump. Trump is trying to push this Russian meddling as a witch hunt, as the all kind of thing. But as the special prosecutor is closing into the entire network of illegal activities over the last 18 months or so, the House and the Senate are sending very clear message. You guys can say whatever you want, but we got your numbers, and we believe that Russia has invaded the U.S. space, if you will, by meddling in our election. The president, probably the only man in the world that doesn't believe that.
Well, Fidel Guide, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Fidel Guide, who's a former senior energy strategist for oil and gas research with Oppenheimer & Company. Mr. Guide has more than 30 years of experience in oil and gas research and has previously been with Mobil Oil and JP Morgan Company. And he is one of the most quoted analysts on energy issues and has testified before the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House of Representatives about oil and gas price speculation. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back examining the Israel Anti-Boycott Act introduced into the Senate by Democrats.
I've been waiting for years to buy a brand new Cadillac. But now that I've got one, gotta send it right back. I can't afford the gas from a brand new limousine. לשתיקות שלך מפנה מקום בלב ללחיצות שלך מפנה מקום בבטן שאוכל לבלוע אותך אני מפנה מקום בתיבה למכתבים שלך.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is MJ Rosenberg, a senior foreign policy fellow at Media Matters Action Network, Previously, he served as the Director of Policy Analysis for the Israel Policy Forum. And prior to that, he spent 18 years within the United States government, 14 on Capitol Hill as a congressional aide. And he was also the editor of the Near East Report, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee's biweekly publication on Middle East policy. Welcome to Background Briefing, MJ Rosenberg.
Thank you.
So what do you make of this AIPAC-sponsored legislation, the Israel Anti-Boycott Act, that has lots of prominent Democrats jumping aboard, Benjamin Cardin, senator, and, of course, Kirsten Gillibrand, another U.S. senator, along with Peter Roskam in the House? On the surface, it looks as though this is criminalizing political speech.
Yes, that is precisely what it would do. Basically, it bans any company, any business, any individual person who does business from boycotting Israel, which basically means not doing business with Israel. It specifically targets speech. Because if you read the legislation just narrowly, the way it's written, it basically says that a company, it's not going to go after a company or an individual that refuses to do business with Israel. It is only at the point that that person or company says, I'm not doing business with Israel because I'm participating in the European Union or United Nations or Palestinian boycott of Israel. So in other words, it's specifically going after speech, because after all, how would they really know if a business is selling garden hoses and they don't sell to Israel, and they sell to other countries and don't sell to Israel? They don't you won't know what the reason is unless that person somehow announces it, or if the boycott movement announces it. So it's really going after the speech as much as the action. It's designed to destroy the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement, the BDS movement, just by scaring people. It's unprecedented. I don't know, remember, boycotts in this country for political reasons are totally legal, beyond legal. They're a recognized form of protest. If you think going back to the Montgomery bus boycott in Rosa Parks, or the boycott of lettuce and grapes to support the farm workers, and the Supreme Court has found that you're allowed to boycott anything you want. I mean, it's the hypocrisy of the Israel lobby is just amazing, because it talks about wanting the Palestinians to resort to peaceful measures in fighting the occupation. Well, what could be more peaceful than a boycott? And yet they're going to war against that. I mean, it's just an incredible thing. I think it's unconstitutional, too. I cannot imagine that if it ever went to the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court would not see boycott as protected speech. But nonetheless, it's a threat.
Well, it's a threat in as much, and the threat is backed up in the bill. Violations will be punishable by civil and criminal penalties of up to $1 million in 20 years in prison.
$1 million. It's amazing. For what? For not doing business with Israel. Is there any, I don't know the answer to this question, but has anyone ever talked about something like this as related to any other ally of the United States? I mean, anybody say, you have to do business with Canada or else? or show that you, I mean, it's just like so many things related to Israel, it's sui generis. It's totally unique. It's just crazy. And this, Cardin tends to, Senator Ben Cardin of Maryland, he's basically his AIPAC. I mean, he does whatever they want. But he was interviewed, and he seemed not to know about the criminal penalties. He didn't know about the, you could wind up in jail for 20 years. He said he'd have to go back and look at that. But that is certainly in the legislation.
And again, I'm speaking with MJ Rosenberg, a senior foreign policy fellow at Media Matters Action Network. Previously, he served as the director of policy analysis for the Israel Policy Forum, and prior to that, spent 18 years within the United States government, 14 on Capitol Hill as a congressional aide. And he was the editor of the Near East Report, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, APEX, biweekly publication on Middle East policy. So this is not likely to put a dent in the BDS movement, which is largely happening in Europe. But I guess they're trying to stamp it out here in the United States, right? There's been movements on campus, has there not, also
in the United States anyway, the BDS movement exists primarily on campus. And what AIPAC does there is, they fight against any of these BDS efforts, not only directly, but they also, most notably at the University of California at Berkeley, they just announced that they would get rid of the members of the student council who voted for a boycott and replace them with members who support it, who took the AIPAC position, and that prevailed. I mean, they're pretty, the other way they do it is with particularly with private universities. If student body, votes for boycott or divestment, the top donors to the university get in touch with them and threaten them. So the AIPAC crowd is very much threatened by this whole by the whole BDS movement. I would think that this legislation is a sign that the BDS movement is being very successful. I want to make one other point. There are a lot of people who, particularly in the Jewish community, who support boycotts as the boycott relates to settlements and products made in the settlements. This legislation there's no distinction. In fact, it makes it clear that boycotting settlements is the same as boycotting Israel. All part of that overall Israel policy that one should forget that there's an occupation and that West Bank settlements are as much Israel as Tel Aviv is Israel. So this is all, it's part of the, Israel's major policy goal now. It's no longer survival. Israel's survival is in no way threatened. Israel, in fact, is probably more secure now than it's ever been. But their number one policy concern now is the occupation, maintaining the occupation, keeping the West Bank, keeping Gaza under blockade, and that's what BDS is targeting. BDS is not targeting the existence of the State of Israel. It's targeting the occupation. And that's how Israel and AIPAC responds is, well, it ignores the word occupation and says this is an anti-Israel boycott. There's nothing in the that's been written by any of the proponents of BDS that says that their goal is to bring down the State of Israel through boycott. Nor does the EU, obviously. The EU doesn't say that, and they support boycott, and the EU and the United Nations, no, their goal, their target is the occupation. And that is what Israel is most zealous about preserving. AIPAC, its lobby, and senators like Ben Cardin and other good, supposedly liberal, progressive senators, you mentioned Gillibrand from New York, mm-hmm. who's supporting it, but she did say that when she was informed about the possibility of criminal penalties, she said she was re-examining the issue. So that's I want to give her some credit for that. But basically, this is all about defending the occupation. The other thing it's about, of course, is there's an election in 2018. AIPAC likes to have enemies to target, to go after in elections who are not supporting the AIPAC line. There aren't that many issues right now. I mean, you know, when Obama was president, or Clinton, and even Bush, there was the peace process. So are you supporting the peace? If you support Israel making compromises in the peace process, you're anti-Israel. You have to stand up to the president for Israel. There's no peace process now. There's nothing going on. So let's make this. Let's make BDS the issue on which we can say, Ben Cardin is a friend of Israel and his opponent is an enemy of Israel, or any of these House members who support it. AIPAC, like the National Rifle Association, which it is almost identical to, needs these dividing issues for organization building and for targeting enemies. It serves organizational goals. I mean, I think it serves organizational goals here for AIPAC much more than it serves Israeli goals. I'm not sure. I think that the BDS is doing some damage, but not damage enough to come up with legislation like this. This, I really think, this is AIPAC and its friends in Congress pushing this. Netanyahu's involved too, but this is AIPAC. AIPAC sees its sway with the Democratic Party being diminished by the rise of the Sanders wing of the party. So it needs a vehicle. Mm-hmm. So it's chosen this as a vehicle.
But Netanyahu was recently in Eastern Europe where he was musing, and he was kind of mystified as to why the Western Europeans are turning against Israel, and the only places where he's popular are in these right-wing anti-democratic countries, Hungary and Poland, where they're turning back the clock. So it doesn't seem that the Netanyahu people get it, that it's right-wing politics that have made Israel the outlier.
No, they totally don't get it. I mean, they have convinced themselves that the reason for this Israel sentiment is all about anti-Semitism. And as I often say to them, well, if the reason that public opinion worldwide despises Benjamin Netanyahu, if that reason was anti-Semitism, why was it that Yitzhak Rabin, when he was prime minister, was the most popular foreign leader in the world and in precisely these same countries? So the French, the British, the Germans, all these people are anti-Semitic now when Netanyahu's prime minister, but they loved Rabin. And the reason was, it's not a question of loving Rabin or not loving Rabin or hating Netanyahu or not hating Netanyahu. They want peace in the region. They want the occupation to end. Any Israeli who pursues an end to the occupation is going to be popular throughout the world. There will be no BDS movement when the occupation ends. Of course, I don't think the occupation is going to end, but the Israelis prefer to make this, the Israelis and their friends here prefer to make this whole thing being about anti-Semitism, which is, I mean, I hate even to say it, to give credence to it by saying it, but it is certainly not about anti-Semitism. But that's Netanyahu is, Netanyahu is excellent at turning former friends of Israel into enemies. And a bill like this, when people hear about it, which I hope they will, and which gets lots of publicity, will make more and more people understand what kind of people are running Israel today, and what kind of people are running its lobby. And also. They'll understand about the members of Congress who supposedly are so liberal and so progressive on so many issues and criticize, rightly so, a President Trump or a President Bush or whatever. But when it comes to Netanyahu, they fall right in line as if they're Mitch McConnell. It's kind of it's a little bit sickening. It's almost like their attitude is my country right or wrong, but it doesn't apply to the United States. It applies to Israel. And that's Ben Cardin. And others like him. And it's never really put to them that way, but it should be. I really would like to say to Ben Cardin, how come you have never criticized anything the Israeli government does, but you have no problems rightly criticizing what the United States does? What's the difference? How come Israel is incapable of wrong, but the United States, your own country, is in fact capable of all kinds of wrong and injustice? It's a ridiculous double standard that they have. And it's not a double standard that favors the United States.
Right. Well, it's obvious that Cardin opposes Donald Trump and makes it clear that he does and opposes
right.
his policy. What's the difference between Donald Trump, Sheldon Adelson, Naftali Bennett, Lieberman, Netanyahu? It's all, again,
yeah.
it's all about right-wing politics. And too many people, I think, that go after Israel on the political left run the risk of sounding as if they're against the entire state of Israel and the Israeli people. They should be much more precise and say this is not about a country. It's about the political direction that a country has taken.
And I know, and they should specifically say the occupation. It's 50 years of occupation. Who imagined in 1967 that it would last 50 years and that Israel would have 500,000 settlers on the West Bank? And that Gaza, which they say that they evacuated, they still have under land, sea, and air blockade. It is not, is there anyone in the mainstream in any country, including the Arab countries, that call for the elimination of the state? All they're talking about is the occupation. Even the Arab League, the famous, Arab League plan, which was originally called the Saudi plan, recognized Israel's right to exist in secure borders but giving up the 67 territories, leaving Israel with 78% of historic Palestine and 22% for the Palestinians. But that's, the fact is the Netanyahu crowd, in contrast to the Rabin Peres crowd of yore, wants it all. And unfortunately, the Israeli people are now very right-wing themselves. It's not like the government of Israel is not representative of the people. Unfortunately, according to every poll, it is. And Netanyahu is very popular. Trump, at least progressives here have the satisfaction of knowing how unpopular Trump is. Netanyahu is very strong in Israel. In fact, there's no comparison between the two.
Sure. Well, just in closing, let me just read the ACLU's analysis of this bill that we're talking about that is called the Israel Anti-Boycott Act. The bill would amend these laws to bar U.S. persons from supporting boycotts against Israel, including its settlements in the Palestinian occupied territories conducted by international governmental organizations such as the United Nations and the European Union. It would also broaden the law to include penalties for simply requesting information about such boycotts. Violations would be subject to a minimum civil penalty of $250,000 and a maximum criminal penalty of $1 million and 20 years in prison. We take no position for or against the efforts to boycott Israel or any foreign country. However, we do assert that the government cannot, consistent with the First Amendment, punish U.S. persons based solely on their expressed political beliefs. So there you have it. If this is a total violation of the First Amendment, it's un-American. I can't see it flying, but as you say, it's probably going to fire up the base and put a lot of politicians.
And I think it'll probably pass both houses.
Right.
It's unless something changes or unless the leadership decides, for some reason not to, But one of the co-sponsors in the House is Steny Hoyer, who's a Democratic Majority Leader.
Right.
So there you have it. And there's no Republicans who are going to oppose this.
Right.
So, I think it'll go the whole way. Then it could, no reason to think it wouldn't be signed by the president. But who knows? You never know who he's angry with at any given day.
Right.
You never predict what he's up to.
Right.
But certainly Jared Kushner would be pushing him to sign it.
Sure. I wouldn't hold my breath on that one. But I thank you for joining us here today, M.J. Rosenberg.
Okay, thank you, Ian. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with M.J. Rosenberg, a senior foreign policy fellow at the Media Matters Action Network. Previously, he served as a director for policy and analyst for the Israel Policy Forum. And prior to that, he spent 18 years within the United States government, 14 on Capitol Hill, as a congressional aide. And he was the editor for Near East Report, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee's APEX biweekly publication on Middle East policy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.